Over the years, our idea of Henry VIII, both as a man and a king, has been shaped by plays and movies and TV shows. But now, the novelist Hilary Mantel has definitively revised that picture. In her novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, she focuses on a less well-known figure around Henry who has always been depicted as a kind of a weasel, Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell was the son of a blacksmith who maneuvered his way to become Henry's right-hand man. The novels have been huge bestsellers, and they both won the Man Booker Prize, which is the big award for English language fiction. In fact, Hilary Mantel is the first woman to win it twice. Now, Wolf Hall has been adapted into both a two-part, five-and-a-half-hour show on Broadway and a Masterpiece Theater miniseries on PBS.
You said in Parliament, in a speech some 6 years ago, that I could not afford a war.
Wars are not affordable things.
When I went into France, I captured the town of Terouanne, which you called...
A dog hole, Majesty.
How could you say so?
I've been there.
So have I. At the head of an army. You told me I could not lead my own troops. You told me if I was taken prisoner, the ransom would bankrupt the country. So what do you want? You want a king to huddle indoors like a sick girl?
That would be ideal for fiscal purposes.
That's Damian Lewis as Henry VIII and Mark Rylance as Thomas Cromwell in the TV version of Wolf Hall. And Hilary Mantel is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360 and congratulations.
Thank you.
So when did you decide that Thomas Cromwell was going to be the subject, your next subject, along with the court of Henry VIII?
I've been thinking about Thomas Cromwell for 30 years, almost ever since I began writing. I had it in the frame as a really good subject. And you wait for someone else to do it because it's so obvious. And... As I saw the 500th anniversary of Henry's accession approaching, I thought, well, you know what? Nobody's done that yet. It's time I got to it.
And what when you say it's so obvious, what was so obvious about it to you?
It's the arc of his story, a blacksmith's son to Earl of Essex.
And in the 16th century, didn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Poor boys, if they were clever and lucky, they could get on through the church, and the church gave them status. But Cromwell didn't do that. He picked his own path. He didn't really climb the steps of the existing power structure. He just brought his own ladder and smashed it through the ceiling.
And it's interesting what an appetite there remains in this country, especially, it seems to me, for the Henry VIII story. Did you know that? When you sort of embarked on this ambitious project?
I suppose that you're looking at an archetype here. You know, he's Bluebeard. He's straight out of the fairy tale.
He really is.
It makes sense the world over.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's a uniquely English story. Nobody else has this monster king of whom we are actually perversely proud.
Well, and indeed, your books and plays make him less of a monster than he has been made before, I would argue.
I try not to judge my characters, really. I ask my readers to walk a mile in their shoes, which is quite difficult when you're looking at a monarch like Henry, who seems such a distant figure. I try actually to see him through Cromwell's eyes, and he sees him close up, and he sees him flawed, and he sees him frightened, and he sees him cold, and visited by ghosts and subject to bad dreams.
Yeah. And it's easier, I think, for readers, and perhaps one of the reasons for the success of the books, to walk a mile in Thomas Cromwell's shoes, who seems more like us than one expects 16th century hangers-on to Henry VIII to be.
That's right. He's humbly born. He has his way to make in the world. But again, it's an archetypal story we all understand. It's the story of the boy who leaves home and he can't go back. He's always got to be going forward.
And doesn't, as so often happens in those stories, especially in antique times, he doesn't put on airs. There's a kind of populist, I'm just this brewer's boy.
He was a cultured and very clever man. But he didn't seem ashamed of his origins, and he didn't pretend to be what he was not. That makes him almost unique in his time.
Yeah. I remember as a child, and when you were a child as well, the big Henry VIII fiction was A Man for All Seasons, which, among other things, made Thomas More, Sir Thomas More, the great hero that at that idealistic moment we were supposed to believe was the great hero of this story. Not so much in your telling.
We've almost deified Thomas More by making him something he would have despised.
Really?
We've made him stand for freedom of conscience and tolerance. Those were not qualities that Thomas More recognized.
As we see, because he was killing heretics like crazy.
He was indeed, and what he stood for was obedience to Rome and conformity in opinion. And if you did not conform to his opinion, he tortured you. And in extremis, burned you at the stake. So this makeover of Thomas More into a 1960s liberal, whilst extremely entertaining, and, yeah, you know, let's not take away from it, it was a very good play, a very good film.
Yes.
It has dominated the imagination of two generations, and it's time to look at that myth again, I think.
Well, I think that's what you have successfully done, is now you have changed the historical reality for people.
Of course, you know, there's a tendency to excuse Thomas More, who was in many ways a great man, as if his persecution of heretics was some kind of weekend hobby. You know, he was a great man, except for this little penchant for torture.
Yeah.
But I won't have this because, you know, it was central to his perception of himself.
Yes.
He was proud of his record as heresy hunter.
Again, as I've said, you depict Cromwell as a guy who is relatable to modern audiences. He has this – his marriage is this respectful-seeming partnership. He thinks people ought to be able to read the Bible in English, which was illegal still. He's this – he pulls himself up by his bootstraps. Did you ever think, I might be putting my 21st century ideas of an idealized Thomas Cromwell onto him?
He's a person who strikes us as having a more modern mentality than his contemporaries. But I'm always conscious that we have to respect people for what they were in their own time. They weren't rehearsals for us, and they're they're not us in some kind of unevolved form. So modern isn't necessarily a compliment.
Right.
I'm trying to look at him as a man of the 16th century, but I'm trying not to slant him so that, as it were, he curries favour with the 21st century.
Just like like people turn Thomas More into a 60s liberal.
But we're all writing out of our own time.
Sure.
That's inevitable.
Yeah. You have been very involved, centrally involved in the plays, the West End and Broadway adaptations of these books, I guess less so with the television miniseries. Did you want to be? Was that like a demand that, no, I'm not just going to sell rights and let somebody else do it?
With the TV series, what I had to do was minimal, but I was there. You don't want to hang over the project of adaptation, but you want to be in the background to help if you can.
You're in the center of these plays. You're still like tweaking lines, I hear.
With the plays, it's different, yes. I've been working with the adapter for a couple of years before we came near the rehearsal room. But I turned up as a kind of walking encyclopedia, as a consultant on Tudor life. And I got drawn into the project. So now, as you say, I've reshaped the scripts for Broadway. I've taken over as writer. We're in preview now, and we're tweaking every afternoon and making our jokes work.
Well, speaking of jokes, one of the big differences between the plays and the books is there's much more comedy in the stage version.
Well, the books are witty. They're droll.
Yeah.
It's you smile. In the theatre, that's not good enough.
Yeah,
you've got to point things.
Yeah.
And you can do that so that a line that you that lies on the page and makes the reader smile becomes laugh-out-loud funny when actors are animating it.
So you've got one more Cromwell novel to go to finish your trilogy. Do you think that working on the play is going to affect how you write that book?
The third book's already well underway, and it is influenced in all sorts of ways by the theatre production, but not stylistically. That hasn't changed. What has changed is the insights I get from the actors, from working with them, what they give me consciously in discussion or subconsciously in performance. The two projects are running very happily alongside each other, the book helping the scripts and the scripts helping the book. I think, though, maybe it will change the way I write in the future because I'd love to write for the theatre.
Yeah. And why not? You can not that you can do anything you want, but you certainly the options are there in front of you. But are you sick of Thomas Cromwell? Will you be goodbye, good riddance, Thomas Cromwell?
I'm more fascinated by him than ever I was. I still can't add him up, and I'm partway through the third book. And I suspect he will elude me at the last, and as soon as his head's off, he'll get up and put it back on again. He's that sort of man.
Exactly. And I could talk about his relative a century later, Oliver Cromwell, whom I want to read the Hilary Mantel version of, but I guess I probably won't get to.
Well, my husband's under instructions, if I start talking about Oliver Cromwell, to shoot me.
Hilary Mantel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Wolf Hall The Plays are on Broadway right now, and the second episode of the Wolf Hall TV series airs on PBS's Masterpiece Theater this weekend. Hilary Mantel and I talked for about 45 minutes about her obsession with historical accuracy, about her next book, and about the time she considered murdering Margaret Thatcher. You can hear all of it at Studio360.org.